see you won. Diamonds on the ring of gold, you say you won. Your story to remain untold, but all the promises we made, from the cradle to the grave.
I have a confession to make, and there is simply no way to say this out loud without sounding shockingly naive or insufferably melodramatic, or like I'm actively trolling my guest and all of you listening. Get ready to roll your eyes or laugh or spit take, whatever. You ready? You two saved me. I said it, you two. Not you, dear listener, also, but you two, the Irish rock band. The group that presumptuously uploaded its entire album onto your iPhone without your knowledge or consent. The band that made that song Sunday Bloody Sunday that you're almost positive is not about the Super Bowl. Yeah, them. Their music found me at an especially low time, the darkest part of my angsty teenage years, a time when I pondered a world without me in it. It wasn't the protest songs or the arena rock anthems that changed my attitude, I promise. It was the deeper, more personal, and yet transcendent love songs that pulled me far enough out of the darkness for my friends to drag me the rest of the way. And yes, it is embarrassing to see that much importance in my life to a quartet of aging millionaire musicians whose every public statement is anticipated to be self-righteous at best. And yes, today it is all too fashionable to bag on you two, but I owe them a debt. So I will cape for Adam Clayton and Larry Mullen Jr., one of the greatest underappreciated rhythm duos in all of rock and roll. And The Edge, one of the most distinctive and visually inspiring guitarists to ever strike a chord. And Bono, whose voice can call down the heavens, who makes secular love songs feel spiritually moving and shows the face of God in sexual gratification. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Fire and Water Records. I'm Ryan Daly, and I invite you to join me and my guest as we walk the streets with no name and discuss the history of the legendary band, U2. My guest this episode is a longtime friend and occasional legal counsel of the Fire and Water Network. You've heard him on previous episodes of Fire and Water talking about Van Halen and Guns N' Roses, as well as on episodes of the Film and Water podcast, Give Me Those Star Wars, and Cheers Cast. Please welcome back Mr. Omar Uden. What's up, man?
Hi, Ryan. I'm happy to be with you. I'm happy to be talking with you about a group that means a lot to me and has meant a lot to me over the last 25 or 30 years. And means a lot to you too.
It does. And you kind of brought this band to me, not as the concept for this episode. You mentioned that you wanted to do them, and I was like, yeah, we can absolutely cover this one. We should have done this about a year ago. But you also brought the band to me when we first met, like one of our first encounters at that aforementioned very dark and depressing stage of my life. You kind of came out of nowhere and like, hey, let's go to Pizza Villa. And you took me, and then we just started hanging out and talking, and you talked about the band. But tell me about like your history with the band. How and when did you first discover U2 and get into them?
My interest in pop music and contemporary pop music and rock pop started to accelerate when I was in middle school, I think. So at that point, I was really immersing myself in a lot of early 90s music and what was popular then. And what was popular then was a lot of the alternative grunge stuff, the Pearl Jam, their Nirvanas. And I always considered myself adjacent to that, someone who appreciated the music but couldn't quite get into it. The band I really first started to like, sort of autonomously on my own, separate and apart from like the influence of an older sibling or like older friends, was R.E.M., who was one of U2's closest contemporaries. And in enjoying all these bands that were sort of U2 adjacent, you know, I invariably heard a lot about U2. I knew they were huge. You know, anyone who followed MTV in the late 80s and early 90s was pretty much saturated by U2 coverage on the MTV News program. They would follow them on tour. In the early 90s, their sort of like genre-defying Zoo TV tour was sort of the talk of the town. So I knew the massive scope of the band, but I don't think I had heard a single record or song of theirs. I just knew that they were this gigantic, Titanic-sized force in pop rock, in music. There was like a Saved by the Bell episode constructed entirely around like the gang trying to like get tickets to see U2. So I just knew of them. And I sort of knew the more I dug in, I got into these other groups, that I would eventually, you know, get to them. And you know, like REM, like I said, contemporaries of them, grew up with them, big admirers of them. Guns N' Roses, a band I really liked, and the band that we've discussed before on the podcast, were really into them. I remember, like, it made an incredible impression on me when Axl Rose, in the early 90s, gave an interview talking about how the Octung Baby record was, like, his favorite album, and he would, like, play it over and over and over and over again. So I kind of knew that I would eventually get into them at some point, and I made a concerted effort. This was around 95 to listen to their most prolific albums. This was War, the Joshua Tree, and Octung Baby. And when I the memory is so distinctive, I can remember where I was when I listened to each of those albums for the very first time. And the kind of spine-tingling sensation I felt when listening to the opening tracks on those records for the very first time, Sunday Bloody Sunday on War, Zoo Station on Octung Baby, and most notably Where the Streets Have No Name on the Joshua Tree. It was this like spine-tingling, hair-raising moment that I have inspired, like, you know, a feeling that I had never gotten from any other medium, you know, films, music, television, books, anything before or anything since. And I've gone on to, you know, like and enjoy, been a fan of, like, you know, like dozens of other things and other forms, other bands, other movies and things like that. But like nothing can compare in terms of the sensory apparatus, the impact to mine as hearing those first strains of those first songs on those albums. Once I listened to them, I was hooked. I was obsessed. I went out, ran out, bought every record. To this day, I have seen U2 in concert more than any other band. I think 7 times over the course of the last like 25 years. The complete digital box that I bought. My first iPod was the U2 themed iPod. I got like the red themed iPhone a few years ago that Bono was talking.
I got the Project Red iPod Nano when that came out.
Yeah, they've really made it really cool. It's super cool. And so like they have continued to make an impression on me. And like, you know, listen, as I've grown up, I've gotten into other things. I've gotten into other, you know, other types of music, other bands. You know, as time has gone on, I've seen something like, you know, like 80 something concerts from like 50, 55, 60 or so artists. But U2 is always, and you know, it's as you alluded to, it's not always been the easiest or the coolest thing to be a fan of U2. It was definitely cool 25 years ago. But now, you know, I'm not going to be melodramatic and say it's been a burden, but like I get a lot of crap from friends and like cultural tastemakers alike for being a huge U2 fan. And I go in cycles myself. There are times when, like, you know, I kind of bury my fandom because it's like the least cool thing in the world to admit. And then there are times, especially in my old age, where I'm totally fine with it and I can sort of wear their uncoolness as a badge of honor. But yeah, like they've made an impression on me that like few other artists in any other medium can lay claim to, for like a whole host of reasons. And even though, you know, just given the demands on my time, like I sort of wax and wane with the amount of time I'm able to devote to them. Once I jump back into that, like a U2 hole, like it takes a while for me to get out of it. And, you know, preparing for this episode is another great example of that. So that's kind of where I am with them.
My earliest memories of U2, I think, are just visual memories. I can distinctly remember the covers of War and the Joshua Tree in my dad's record collection like visually those album covers, and especially War with like the close up of the child's face and how stark it seemed, and the Joshua Tree, how sprawling it seemed. Like it just like it felt like a movie, just that cover. That was it. And then yeah, watching, you know, music, television, everything, and seeing the videos, especially the videos for the Joshua Tree, Where the Streets Have No Name, With or Without You, especially. Their early 90s stuff, which is now, you know, my favorite stuff, kind of slipped under my radar. Like, I knew of them from the Joshua Tree, but by the time they were getting to Octoon Baby, I think because I was on the other track, I was so much more immersed in the Seattle grunge sound and the Pearl Jams, the Nirvanas, everything like that. And then also just like having, you know, an awareness of the hip hop and everything. So you two somehow, Octoon Baby, I knew of it. And I think I knew that there was a video for Mysterious Ways because I think it was on an episode of Beavis and Butthead. They reviewed like that is one of those videos. So I knew there was that video, but then that was kind of it. And like Zooropa was right under my radar. And I'd never really thought about them or gave much credence to them as a contemporary band that I might be interested in until 1995, when they had a song, Hold Me, Thrill Me, Kiss Me, Kill Me, on the soundtrack to Batman Forever. And that kind of got me excited for them in their own right. And then a year later, they come out with Pop. And I liked it at the time, but I didn't love it. It wasn't necessarily what I was looking for. It didn't sound like the other music that I was really into at the time. So I just kind of shelved it in my mind. I was like, I can respect this. I like this, but this isn't necessarily what I'm hoping for. And then it was a year or two after that. Maybe it was 1998, late 1998.
Yeah, they had a little bit of a resurgence then because they dropped their first greatest hits album and they accompanied it with their single, The Sweetest Thing. So I think when you first started getting into them around that fall of 98 era, when you and I started like becoming friends and hanging out, they had sort of a mini resurgence commercially and on the radio because The Sweetest Thing was, you know, a nice little throwback single, especially after the bombast of Pop.
Right. And it was the summer before that when we sort of connected because a mutual girlfriend of ours, mutual girlfriend of a lot of people at the time, broke my heart and everything. And that was sort of what united us and brought us into the same sort of sphere. And and then I for whatever reason, I don't know if it was pity or for need of a pet or something, but yeah, you asked me out to pizza and we just like spent the afternoon just talking about a whole bunch of stuff. And I remember you talking about you two and this band and like shilling for all of these like songs and albums that I hadn't heard. And I was like, all right. And then I went home and I think my dad did actually have a copy of Octoon Baby. And
well, I think the reason I brought them up was like, I think I knew you at least well enough at that point to know that like you were into music, like you were into contemporary music, you were into rock. And, you know, my barometer with people at that point, I mean, I still feel this way to an extent, but my barometer with people, especially at that point, was like, I could not take you seriously if you professed to be a fan of like contemporary rock and you were sort of indifferent to U2 or didn't like U2. So yeah, like I was, you know, part of being a super fan, especially with a band like U2, is just sort of being a super annoying evangelist about them.
And then, yeah, I mean, I listened to that album and the sort of rest is the history that we will unfold during this. But without spoilers, Octoon Baby is one of my all-time favorite albums. It is one of those that I call like the no-skip album, that every single track on that album is great.
I think that, you know, and again, I'm sure we'll get into it, but we've alluded to the fact that, like, you know, you take a lot of incoming for being a U2 fan. And I've sort of made my peace with it at this point in my life. But what I will say is, you know, even if you don't like them for whatever reason, and, you know, I'll cop to the fact that there might be legitimate reasons why someone might not like them. But like, you cannot with a straight face, you know, and again, I know it's all about finding your joy and I know it's all about everything is subjective. It's up to your opinion. But like, it's hard for me to take someone seriously if they, you know, sort of profess to broadly like the kind of, you know, music that, like, I tend to like and that you tend to like, that you just tend to talk about on this podcast, and not at least acknowledge that Achtung Baby and the Joshua Tree, you know, deserve their spots, respective spots in the pantheon of, like, the all-time great pop rock albums. Like, and you know, there are a lot of people who are able to sort of grudgingly admit that. They'll say, you know what, I hate that band, I hate Bono, I think they're insufferable, blah, blah, blah. But yeah, whatever, like, Joshua Tree and Achtung Baby are really good. If you don't say that, then, like, I don't really have much to say to you at this point. And I would even take it a step further and say, look, they have a lot of other, I mean, even to an objective, like, non-super fan or non-fan, they have a lot of great stuff on a lot of their other albums, and a lot of their other albums deserve, you know, consideration. But, like, those two, I just think are critically and, you know, from a music fan standpoint, like, unassailable. So yeah, like, your thoughts on Achtung Baby, I completely agree. And if I hated you two, I would still love Achtung Baby.
All is quiet.
Let's rewind. Let's go back before then, all the way back to their early years, 1980 to 1985. Basically, their first albums before the Joshua Tree, we've got Boy, October, War, and The Unforgettable Fire. From this era, I like a few of their songs. I've kind of gotten into them. At this point, they were much more of a European punk band. That very much, like, by their own admission, very much still trying to find their way, still trying to learn how to play their instruments. There's a lot of raw energy in this, which I do like in those songs, but nothing necessarily that really, really grabs me. The standout track of this whole era would be the song Bad from The Unforgettable Fire. And I would even say that the live version that was on Wide Awake in America in 1985 is better than Unforgettable Fire.
Well, I would agree the live version of Bad is the one that really, you know, is the one that really slaps for people. I mean, I would say that not just the live one on Wide Awake for America. I think the live version on the Live Aid television show, like the huge gigantic television show, which really marked them for, you know, that was really their coming out party in terms of the world. Now I have obviously a different feeling about those early albums as a super fan, but I also would say that, you know, those early albums, and I think, again, from an objective standpoint with a lot of people, they would throw, like, the War album and, to an extent, The Unforgettable Fire alongside some of those, you know, like, alongside the very best U2 albums as, like, fully representative of what they're capable of. Mm-hmm. But I would agree with you that, like, I think those first four records point to a sort of raw, youthful ambition, and you can sort of hazily see the edges and the beginnings of greatness. But I just want to be clear, I think they represent a lot of what is to come in terms of their versatility as songwriters, producers, and craftsmen. I mean, you look at those earlier albums, look at that Boy album, like, my God, those songs were written when Bono was like 18, 19 years old. And what's impressive about it and the first couple ones, Boy, October, War, is they portend the way that U2 straddles so many genres and is so versatile. Like, you could have conceivably classified U2 as alternately a post-punk new wave group based on Boy, a Christian band, which they unabashedly were during October, and October reflects that, and a lot of their future songs reflect that. And a college alternative band in the realm with REM based on, like, War and The Unforgettable Fire. I mean, they were competing with REM, like, on the college charts. And then, you know, you get to, like, sort of the mainstream rock that they achieved with Joshua Tree and Joshua Tree and Rattle and Hum, and, like, sort of the mainstream alternative sound competing with Nirvana and Pearl Jam with Achtung Baby, and then, like, electronica and ambient stuff, and then back to mainstream rock in the early 2000s, and now, like, classic rock. It's just, like, those early albums sort of portended to me how versatile they were as songwriters. I do think the Bad song, especially the live version, sort of brings to life and resonates for people in a way that I haven't seen before. When that song came out in Live Aid, the Rolling Stone put them on the cover, their cover in 1985, and labeled them the band of the 80s. This, despite never having a number one album, you know, in the United States, nor a number one single, but it was just based on the sort of potential energy that they had off of that performance, off of that song. But, you know, I would just not overlook some of the singles from that period, like the I Will Follows, the Out of Controls from Boy, Gloria from October, Sunday, Bloody Sunday, which is just like a staple of their live shows off of War, New Year's Day, which is also a staple, and also Pride in the Name of Love. You know, the single off of Unforgettable Fire, even more than Bad, that's resonated with people. So, like, if their career ended after Unforgettable Fire, you know, just after Bad, you would have a conceivable argument for them to be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. But, like, what's impressive about U2 is, like, the energy from those albums and those songs more spoke to potential than anything else. And really, you know, just spoke about them as a live act and the power of their, you know, their live performances. I think, you know, they really did inherit the mantle from The Who as like the preeminent live act of their time. And that's based on, you know, the live album that came out after War called Under a Blood Red Sky, which millions of people bought. And, you know, the Bad performance from Live Aid reflected in the Wide Awake in America album. So there's a lot going on those first few years.
One man on a barbed wire fence. One man he resists. One man washed on an empty beach. One man.
Pride in the Name of Love. Like, talk about like one of those like that you just identify as like an arena rocker. This is a song that demands to be played in a football stadium and just like shouted out, where you're just like looking up to the clouds and just like just bringing it down. And like,
and I
like,
think that's notable. That is notable because it speaks to an ambition in their songwriting and their presence
that they didn't have at the time in terms of success. Yeah.
Yeah, and yes, that they didn't have, you know, was disproportionate to what they had already done up to that point. But more tellingly, I think, was also at odds with the rock and roll ethos, which is like, you know, Bono's big complaint about like bands, particularly American bands, is that they sell you their street level, that they, you know, it is somehow uncouth and uncool to want more. It is somehow like something to be ashamed of, to have these earnest ambitions to sing for like tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of people, where like, you know, the magic of rock is sold to us as like, you know, oh, there's something raw and primal and authentic about like intimacy. And Bono is like, you know, screw that. We want to connect with like millions of people at once. And for like 20, 25 year olds, like pious 25 year olds, that's something where you take a lot of hits for. And, but I think it just speaks to this swing for the fences mentality that they've always had in their recording and in their, you know, in their ambition, in their live performances, that is, could alternately be embarrassing. And I think it is kind of embarrassing in a way, but when it connects, man, it connects.
And with Bad, I think they tapped into this magical formula that they will repeat on some of their more, I don't even like to call them ballads, but on some of their more accessible and sort of transcendent pop songs, this sort of formula of the rhythm section with Adam and Larry, and just like Adam's bass in particular just sounds like it sounds like he's playing more than one instrument, not like at the time, but it feels like it's doing the work of more than one instrument, more than one bass guitar, in how it fills up the volume. Because when the Edge plays the melody, a lot of times, like with that song, like it might be a little bit off note, or it might just kind of like come in like from the corner of the song or something like that. It's a little bit askew, but it strikes this kind of more organic, kind of jazzy feeling. And meanwhile, Bono is almost sing-talking as he's like expressing this thought in a much more, you said, intimate way. And he's kind of like, you know, conveying these feelings about self-destruction or whatever you translate the song to be meaning. And he can flip it from being very right beside you in your ears, kind of just talking at a regular volume, to belting out, you know, with his voice the way it carries. And yeah, that type of, they will do that song in various forms again and again, and it's always one of the more magical and like expressive songs. So.
It's transcendent, and like I think that song, that live performance, sort of epitomizes the U2 live experience. Mm-hmm. And you know, the way you describe that bass sound, I always think of it as like absolutely a primal throbbing sound.
Yes, I have that in my notes for some of their other songs. Like,
yeah, like he brings it, and then it just makes him so like unique and versatile. Like as a bass, it's not like a garden variety rhythm section. What I would also say about Bono, and again, like, you take the good and the bad with this, but I think on balance, there's more good. Like, the way you describe the manner in which he opens up and bleeds for his audience, he always describes himself, and it's very amusing, and it's as like, his aspiration is to be a soul singer, and it's just like, well, what are you talking about? He's like, I want to be a soul singer, and a singer becomes a soul singer when he decides to reveal rather than conceal. And, like, the lack of irony and, like, withholdingness in a rock and roll singer is pretty unique. And I think that is what allows them and him specifically to forge a connection with his audience. And, like, there's no better example of that than the plane of wailing he does on Bad and, like, the sort of sing-talking he does to, like, sort of convince himself and the audience of, like, where he's trying to go. And you know, we can talk about The Edge a little bit more later too, but like, I also think that like, this speaks to the power of The Edge's, you know, technique, because he's not in the vein of like the classic guitar heroes of like the Jimi Hendrix and the Jeff Becks and the Eric Claptons or whatever. Like, there is a minimalist approach that he like very unabashedly talks about how like, so there are so many moments and so many songs where like he could go off on some like machine gun, like guitar rant. And he just reins it in because he knows like there's like a sort of power in like the restrained guitar technique. But like Bad epitomizes that. And it also epitomizes like with that Edge sound, like say what you will about that band, but like, you cannot say that the Edge is not asymmetrical in how he sounds. Like there, when you listen to a U2 guitar sound, you know, it is U2, not in a tiresome way. It is the Edge. It is that weird echoey reverb thing that is like so stunning and so charming. And like, it gets you really in the gut. And I think Bad is a perfect example of that.
Yeah. And I mean, when we get to like, you know, Joshua Tree and Rattle and Hum, like I mentioned, he's a visually inspiring guitar player because I think he does paint pictures with those notes. And like somehow he's able to, you see things behind your eyes when you're listening to his guitar work. I like the, you mentioned Bono talking about being wanting to be a soul singer, because I think the best song they ever created is a soul song at heart. And we'll come back to that one, a little bit later. Anything else before we jump forward to?
Yeah, like, I mean, I would just give I would really evangelize to the audience who are less familiar with that early catalog as like, look, I think a lot of these things are valuable. A lot of early catalogs of bands are valuable more as a guide to where they're going. And I think that's accurate in U2's case, but I also think that like the stuff on its own stands like very powerfully. The War album is like one of the great records of the 1980s. It's like urgent, it's primal. I think Boy is one of the like 5 or 10 best debut records of all time. I think the singles that they have are, you know, from that period, from like the 1980 to 85 period, are just astonishing in their power. Like the fact that Sunday Bloody Sunday, Pride in the Name of Love, New Year's Day are still brought like 30 years later out in the live format, and like they get the biggest, some of the biggest call and responses from the audience, you know, that tells you something. I just could not recommend those early albums enough, particularly Boy, War, Unforgettable Fire. But it is a testament to the power of U2 that as great as those albums were, the big thing that music critics and audiences kept thinking as they were listening to War, as they were listening to Unforgettable Fire, is, oh my God, this is awesome. And when these guys really hit, they're going to like knock it out of the park, which is essentially what you get with Joshua Tree.
They step up their songwriting by kind of, for the first time, like by basically digging into the roots, not necessarily of their own cultural roots or their own musical roots, but the roots of America. And for the first time, the band is kind of channeling the history of American musical forms. But lyrically and thematically, Bono is trying to contrast the myth of American excellence with the American reality that he's seeing on TV in Ronald Reagan's America, and what's happening with, you have extreme poverty, sickness, drugs, with America's foreign policy in particular, and all of these things, this culture clash between dream and reality, mythology and modernity, and all of this. And the album is big, it is sprawling, I said it was kind of cinematic. You get that from the artistic layout of the album, the fact that they're all kind of in a desert, the desert is very American. You don't get a lot of deserts in Europe where these guys are growing up, so it just feels exotic and new, and for them to be diving into, a history of kind of music that we might have taken for granted, but it's just, they tap into something, like you said, primal and engaging. And I think there's going to be a difference when we talk about the Joshua Tree and Rattle and Hum, even though Rattle and Hum very much sprung out of the live sessions and was sort of a continuation of the Joshua Tree. I think with the Joshua Tree, where it works is because they were inspired by these forms and they were using it to try and enhance the songwriting that they were already doing. And I feel like where Rattle and Hum might have stumbled and where it might have lost focus, even though I love it, I think its flaws might have been when the band was trying to be an American band.
I think that's a really great way to put it, the contrast between the two of them. I would say that, the story of the Joshua Tree, I think, is the story of just sort of like this perfect alchemy and everything coming together at the right moment. Just like when I was talking about earlier about how you could see those first couple of albums as like a progression towards something. You could see them improving as songwriters and craftsmen, and like, and as members of a production team, and they very much are collaborative in the production. Steve Lillywhite famously produced the first three records through War. But when they did Unforgettable Fire, they brought in Daniel Lanois and Brian Eno, formerly of Roxy Music, and who had worked with like Talking Heads and whatnot.
And Flood is the recording engineer, too.
And Flood is the recording engineer, and Flood would go on to have a very prominent place in the U2 pantheon. Like, these guys were all coming together at the exact right time, and where Unforgettable Fire took the sort of rock format and like upended it a little bit by introducing sort of like a faw, like the barest of ambient, like soundscapes, and allowed them to sort of like just kind of do their watercolors the way they want, but imposing it within like a general, song structure. I think Joshua Tree was just this perfect meeting of like Bono really coming into his form as his own as a songwriter. As you said, like using America and like their feelings of traveling through America, like touring in the mid-80s, as sort of the sonic and songwriting backdrop for these observations, America as like aspirational and America as sort of a critical examination. But I think the key distinction you make is these four guys standing outside of America, commenting on America, having been in America and loving America. And that's what makes the Joshua Tree just kind of like hit from the get-go. I mean, from the get-go, there is this like rush of confidence. If you left Bad and the mid-80s thinking, I wonder what these guys have up their sleeve next, those first opening chords of Where the Streets Have No Name, I mean, I defy anyone to sort of introduce an album opener that like shimmers with the kind of like boldness and brashness and confidence that song has. And it just takes you on this journey through the country thematically that is just pitch perfect. Pitch perfect from a songwriting standpoint, pitch perfect from like an anthemic standpoint, pitch perfect from like a sonic standpoint. And, you know, I just cannot say enough about like just even like those first three singles. Like I think With or Without You and I Still Haven't Found What I'm Looking For became like their first and only like number one singles in America. And it is hard, man, for a rock band to have a number one single in America. That's just not done. And the fact that, like, you know, they constructed this perfect pop song with or Without You, and this perfect, you know, and I don't know which song exactly you were referring to a couple minutes ago about like a, you know, a soul song. But for me, I Still Haven't Found What I'm Looking For, you know, sort of hits that mark like quite well. But I just think there's a confidence and a verve to the songwriting and production that I don't know whether it's accidental or the right elements meeting at the right time, but like that's about as perfect as you get in a pop rock landscape.
I wasn't talking about a song on this album, but I mean, I certainly could. And I do think With or Without You is a perfect pop song, as you described it. It is, I think it's one of the greatest pop songs ever written. I think it owes to what we were talking about, the rhythm section having this driving kind of primal feeling bass that's almost tribal in that it sounds like a heartbeat or some kind of organic engine kind of beating. And then the Edge's guitar also feels like an engine just kind of like driving this thing along. And then the lyrics, I think they are simple and yet also a little bit inscrutable. So I think that kind of helps. It helps make it the song easy for fans to sing along with it, but not like so catchy sing-song, kind of like bubblegum pop, that it still kind of keeps you a little bit at an arm's distance. But it's one of those where once you've heard it, it's like, oh yeah, I can sing along with this. I know all these words. There's something hypnotic about it. And it just gets into it, and it feels like a big brother to Bad. It feels like the next evolutionary step in the same type of prototypical like thing. They're just evolving it into its next animal. And yeah, it's this amazing thing. Back to what you said about the opener with Where the Streets Have No Name, I think it's telling with the video, the live video movie of Rattle and Hum, how it goes through like the different chords, and they do bring back some of the live performances from some of the other songs, not just on the album, but when they do the live version of this song about an hour into it, it has been a black and white movie up until that point.
Yep. Yep.
But when the opening notes, the sort of strings begin, yep, with this one, it goes into color.
That's a really good point. I would also note the other transition that it makes in the movie. I would really recommend that movie, by the way. The other transition it makes is up to that point in the film, it is not only black and white, but they are playing in an indoor arena, which is a big enough intimidating, you know, they're playing at the old McNichols Sports Arena in Denver, Colorado, which is, you know, again, a pretty big venue, as big as any band could hope for. You're talking about like, you know, 20,000 people, 20,000, 22,000, you know, sized audience. And that is imposing and intimidating enough. The other change that happens when they go to Where the Streets Have No Name, it's not just they go into Technicolor, they go from that indoor sports arena to the Sun Devil Stadium in Tempe, Arizona, where the Arizona State and the Arizona Cardinals played. And it just shows the scope. That is a song about scope. That is a song with sweeping scope. And to go from, you know, an audience of 22,000, which is like massive and impressive, but like, okay, now we're just gonna take things up a notch, and we're gonna like play music that was suited for a freaking football stadium of 70,000 people. Again, goes to their ambition, the ambition and urgency of their sound and how they want to communicate that. And I think Where the Streets Have No Name is to this day still their best and most urgently, you know, sought after concert anthem. It's the one that always brings people back. You know, I remember they had arguably one of the best Super Bowl halftime performances in American history. And it's not a coincidence that, you know, like, or 15 years after that song came out, that was one of the three songs that they played. you know, in 2002. It is just a song that gets people. It's just a song that, like, sort of captures the anthemic ambition and scale, widespread sweeping scale of U2. It is as close to a perfect, you know, rock song as you're going to get in terms of capturing their focus. And I think it sets the tone for an album that I think, from a songwriting standpoint, from a production standpoint, stands alongside the greatest albums of the 1980s, Thriller and Purple Rain and Born in the USA. It's just a stunning achievement.
And then sticking with that album, but following after those, that 1-2-3 punch of those opening singles, get to what might be my favorite song on the album, which is Running to Stand Still.
I love that song.
Yeah, and now we're like switching gears because we're getting into a slow acoustic ballad, and this one wears the American folk rock roots on it with the acoustic guitar and the harmonica and everything. Yeah. And this one has always left an impression on me, and I will bleep out their names, but like this takes me to, you know, that summer between my sophomore and junior year where we went to graduation party. He had a party like the family farm or something like that. And I was outside, like sitting by his treehouse talking to and it was when I started being really close friends with her, and we kind of spent the night just kind of like talking and chatting and opening up all these new things as I was still going through the heartbreak of what had come before. And like you were there, and I think you drove me there and brought me home too. And
Man, I was a really good friend.
Yeah, you were. And again, we knew each other for like 5 minutes before that.
Yeah.
But yeah, this song, I remember this song being played like it, almost as like a soundtrack accompaniment as I was like sitting in this treehouse with this girl just talking about what we thought our futures would be like with this song kind of playing in the background. So it's always going to kind of resonate and have this personal connection with me. That's why I said in my intro, as much as I love their arena rock, you know, knock the walls down songs or their protest movements, it's Bono's ability to just communicate in this very quiet and intimate way that some of their more personal and seductive songs for me have always been better. Even like a song, like it's a different type of song, but the last song on this album, Mothers of the Disappeared, is another one of my favorite.
It's beautiful.
Yeah, and that's another quieter song.
Yeah. I mean, like, listen, it's part of the genius of U2 and the genius of Bono as a lyricist is that even with these grand sweeping ambitions in the songwriting and with music that is loud and echoey and primal and who-like, in terms of like getting people like jumping up and down, it is those intimate songs. It is those running to stand stills that are really, I mean, the other stuff can sell you and it can hook you, but this stuff really, you know, like makes you understand like sort of the genius quality to them as writers, as craftsmen, as people who can like strike up like intimate conversations with audience members. And just parenthetically, I would also say, Ryan, it's very telling to me that, you know, this is a song you've been going to bat for, Running to Stand Still, alongside the other song that you went to bat for earlier, Bad. They are both thematically about the same thing. They are both about friends of Bono's that were lost to heroin addiction growing up in Dublin. And it's just quite so telling that like one is just like, they're both deeply intimate in their subject matter and how they connect with people. But like one has this like loud, shimmering, you know, getting people jumping up and down and screaming. And this other one is just so haunting in a lot of ways, you know. You put in
all the damage done. It's like a Neil Young type of thing or a Dylan type of thing. Yeah.
And you talked about Mothers of the Disappeared. I would also put in a plug for One Tree Hill, mm-hmm. which is about a colleague of theirs that was lost in a motorcycle accident. And it's just this beautiful, lilting, you know, like song that they have just thrown together at the last minute is like a tribute to like a fallen colleague and friend. It's I don't know, there are just so many. This album is just about landscapes. I don't know how I'll put it more intelligently than that. It's hard to articulate exactly, but like it is an album about landscapes and sort of like the openness and bigness of America and the possibilities of America, and it's just it's just a very emotional experience. And again, like, I would defy anyone. I could put, and it's very Beatlesque in that, like, I could sit like cranky, like 70-year-olds in front of it, you know, in front of the record player. And I could sit like, you know, 12-year-olds in, you know, in front of their phones. And like, I think if you didn't tell them who made it, they would be like, this is really good. This is really good. I can get into this. And that's, you know, in this fragmented landscape, that's kind of all you can say. You know, that's as much as you can say for a band.
You gotta cry without weeping, talk without speaking, scream without raising your voice. You know I took the poison from the poison stream, then I floated out of here.
So picking up off of that and like kind of going into Rattle and Hum, and again talking about like the type of songs that spoke to me, the last track on this one, All I Want Is You, is another one of those kind of like slow ballads similar to what we talked about that has this very kind of quiet, intimate scope. But then by the end of it, this might be my favorite guitar work of the Edge has ever done. Maybe, but yeah. That's not even getting into Octane Baby, so I can't. Yeah. I don't know if I can say that, but. Where the way he comes in out of nowhere with his guitar, like halfway through the song, and just lifting it for like the last minute and a half.
But it's all within that restrained structure of the song format, you know? It's not going off like half baked. And again, I take my hat off to Hendrix and all these guys that can do that and make it work. But like his genius is in like his discipline of like painting within like the format of the song, painting within like the four corners of like the song structure. And that's what makes his guitar work at the end of All I Want Is You so like powerful.
It's crunchy but also twangy. It feels like the chords on the guitar are too loose so that they just kind of have this extra vibration. It's an incredible one. Another song, I mean, like, there's so many on Rattle and Hum that I really do like. It's, if I listen to it start to finish, the album to me feels a little bit disjointed, a little bit unfocused. That is one of the criticisms that I've heard about it. And like I mentioned before, I think where they stumble is trying to not just draw inspiration from American history, but trying to recreate it.
It's almost like a Zelig Forrest Gump type thing, right? Whereas like with the Joshua Tree, it's like they're standing outside in it or like they're there, but they're like clearly travelers observing and loving, but from a distance. Mm-hmm. And with Rattle and Hum, it's like, hey, we're in it. We're like, you know, the Tom Hanks Forrest Gump character with like Richard Nixon or JFK or whatever. And it's just like, hey, Ma, look at me. And again, that album was the first time they had sort of been knocked off course by the critics. I think time has been a little kinder to that record, particularly given like the amount of like all-time great U2 songs that are on it. All I Want Is You is like an all-time favorite U2 song. I think Desire is incredible.
The collaborations they have with B.B. King is incredible. Like the song that they did with Bob Dylan.
Hawkmoon 269. Love Rescue Me. That's right. Yeah. And he played organ on Hawkmoon 269, which is one of my favorite songs on that album. How about the Billie Holiday song, Angel of Harlem? And Bono describes that as like their one jukebox song. Where it's like, oh yeah, this is like absolutely a song that we would you can play on a jukebox and it works. I honestly think, and again, like the common criticism of like big sprawling albums, and I think Rattle and Hum has like 17 or 18 tracks on it. And, you know, and again, it's important to remember, it is essentially operates as a soundtrack to the concert film. And it is a good movie. And I think people should see it. But like they took incoming from people because they were just seen as just these sort of pious, overly serious, you know, like posers. Who, you know, really wanted to like mug around for the camera, like, and go to Graceland and like go to like, you know, the Sun Studios and pretend like that's them. And it's like, hey, this isn't you. Stop trying to like pretend to be something that you're not. And like, I get that to a point, I would simply say that, like, within that big sprawling album, there is probably one of the all-time great EPs out there, but I think even if you made it a regular album of like 8, 9, or 10 songs, it would still be excellent. I think Rattle and Hum's reputation is better, has been better served by time. But I do think that the general criticism of them that, like, hey, listen, you've taken this American project as far as it can go. You are not one of us. You have other important business to be in. And this is just where they get knocked off course for the first time. People start to take their hits at them. And I remember, like, they felt it. They really honestly felt it. And I remember, like, they gave their last concert of the 80s on December 31st, 1989. And I remember Bono said goodbye to the audience by saying, you know, it's no big deal. We just have to go away and dream it all up again.
Yeah, which they would. And but right before we get to the next album, I did want to linger with the Rattle and Hum version of Bullet the Blue Sky. And how good that is, and it, already a great song from the album The Joshua Tree, but on that live version in particular, like the way the drums and bass sound kind of militaristic, and the Edge, like he weaponizes the chords in that, like that. I mean, like he plays a guitar that makes you see missiles firing overhead.
Oh, that's such a great way of putting it.
Launchers.
Yeah,
just the visual, what you get with that song from the vocals to the music, just the energy about it. And not for nothing, but you have to watch the live version of it that's in the movie, and everything, like the whole little, the gimmick, the shtick that Bono does with the spotlight when he's pointing it at the Edge.
Yeah. But,
I mean, they recreated it for the cover of it, and it's, so it's pretty striking.
That was the version of the song that made me really like that song, because it is at first listen a kind of off-putting song, especially after, you know, on the Joshua Tree, especially after, like, you know, the pure gold that is those first three singles, and right before Running to Stand Still, which is also lovely and bracing and everything. But like that one was almost I felt it to be almost deliberately alienating on the album version, but it really comes to life on Rattle and Hum, say what you will about it. But like, yeah, and again, like playing around with like the air horn, and you know, like it just gives rise to like Bono's bombastic, pompous side, but like he can sell it. And if you buy into the premise, then like, then you're with him the whole way, and he seems like marginally less ridiculous. You're along for the ride and it's great. But you know, it's just other aspects of Rattle and Hum maybe age a little less well. Like I, you know, when he's, again, I love the idea of them hobnobbing with the Black Church in San Francisco or wherever that was. And because I do actually think that like there's an analogy to be made between like the U2 concert experience and the U2 live experience and like being in church. And I think Bono aims for that a little bit. And Bruce Springsteen does this a little bit too.
Yeah.
You know, there's like a hokiness. There's like sort of a call and response thing that like would just be embarrassing in a vacuum, and they kind of make it work. But like, yeah, just maybe you delve a little bit too much into that with Rattle and Hum. You know, they try to do this, like they got try to get a Black Church choir to like accompany. I still haven't found what I'm looking for. It's an interesting experiment. But I think at some point you push the envelope a little too much. And I think that's kind of where they were creatively. Yeah, I think they took that. They went on that journey as far as it could go.
And then, as you alluded to, Bono says the band at the end of the 80s has to go away and kind of reinvent itself. And boy, did they. It's no secret that the stars are falling from the sky. It's no secret that our world is in darkness tonight. They say the sun is sometimes eclipsed by a moon. You know, I don't see you when she walks in the room. 1991, they came out with Octoon Baby. Now, I wouldn't really devour the album until 1998, as I said, and instantly, I think it was this instantaneous, like this is a transformative musical experience when I had it, and just like all the way to the very end, and just like every song, and like I think it's telling that it has a very strong opening. my favorite songs are the last half of the album, like the ones that like other people would have forgotten about. But I think it's just, it's very well balanced that way. And I do think it is a top five album of all time for me personally. I do think it's one of those no skip albums. And when I heard it, it just, like, even like at that time, having the alternative rocks, listening to Beck and Radiohead and being fluent in these bands at the time, but it still, it didn't sound like what I had heard before. The album Octoon Baby feels industrial without being a techno album.
Yep.
And it feels urban without being African American, like without that sort of like connotation to it.
Well, the best part about it doesn't feel American at all.
It doesn't at all. That is the thing. Like, whereas you feel this from the Joshua Tree, all about embracing urban. All about embracing America and the sprawl and the openness. Octoon Baby has this overwhelming, pervading sense of the city. And the grit of the city, the industrialization, the metropolitan, the claustrophobia, and like the technological spreading, and it just feels like old school, old world European. This also coincides with my first trip to Europe in 1999 when I went to Greece, and I fell in love with the city of Athens. And during the day, we would tour the architectural landmarks, the monuments and the museums and all these things. But at night, we would leave the hotel and we would wander these streets and kind of witness from a distance the club scene and the drinking and all of these things. So there was just like this push and pull between those two worlds that I was experiencing in my own personal life, and I was feeling on this album. It was this perfect meld that made it for me.
That impression you get was not by accident. I mean, I know a lot of it has to do with sort of like what was going on with you personally, and what you're seeing in your first abroad trip, but that was a very deliberate decision by the band. You know, I think exploring that, they realized that they sort of exhausted the themes of exploring America, even though they would come back to America and thematically and use America as the backdrop in like the rest of their work for the rest of their career. There was a very conscious decision to be inspired by the sounds of what was happening in Europe. That was, the recording of this, they deliberately, moved to Berlin to
right after the fall.
Yeah, specifically in the Hansa Studios in Berlin, where David Bowie had recorded the Low Heroes Lodger trilogy with Brian Eno. And this was, as you alluded to, around the fall of the Berlin Wall, around the fall of the Soviet Union, when all these new countries, the post-Soviet satellite states of Eastern Europe and the post-Soviet republics were like gaining independence and like kind of blindly feeling themselves out as like newly established countries. And they wanted to capture that energy. And it was really also represented the only time the band ever came close to breaking up. I mean, that there's been remarkable harmony and unity in that band. I mean, I should note parenthetically that, all four original members are still in it. In fact, they're doing their, a Las Vegas run this year. And it's the first time that one of the band members won't be there because, he's had to undergo, the drummer Larry Mullen Jr. has had to undergo multiple surgeries. But they've been a remarkably stable unit.
Yeah.
But this was the first and only time they'd come close to breaking up. And it was because of this divide in the band where Larry and Adam, the rhythm section, wanted to continue sort of along this American roots music, exploration that they were undergoing. And I remember hearing about one particularly fierce fight, Bono was like, "What are you listening to right now?" And Larry Mullen was just like, "Hendrix, I'm trying to see how, Cream. I'm trying to see how like the people who did it before us did it." And Bono's like, "Are you kidding? The Edge and I are listening to like Nine Inch Nails and like KMFDM and My Bloody Valentine. And we're just kind of like being inspired by the sounds of New Europe." And you get that from the get-go, you get that from the cover art, which is this kaleidoscopic, they have like a little like, I don't even remember what those like, those crappy East European, those tiny East European cars were called.
Yeah.
That just like didn't move. And like, you got it from the mosaic of all these photographs, like on the cover of the album that establishes frenetic pace. You get it from the industrialized sounds of Zoo Station, the opening track. They released their first single on that album, which was track 7, called The Fly, which is like one of the biggest middle fingers to like mainstream charts you can imagine. But despite all of that frenetic change, it is still within the U2 song structure. And despite having, you know, the bringing in Flood as the primary engineer or primary producer, not just the engineer, as well as Eno and Lanois again, you come up with a finished product that stands alongside the Joshua Tree, stands alongside the great, great albums of like post-war history. I would call that like a top 10 album of all time. I just think in its breadth, its depth, its versatility, its exploration of themes of like that are just personal, not just like haltingly, like, you know, tangentially personal, like with Joshua Tree, but also like talking about like love and sex and desire and like searching for God, but in like the carnal way, mm-hmm. you know, like just explicit references to oral sex in like, you know, Until the End of the World. And like, you know, just the plaintive, like, you know, like melodies of one, like it is a near perfect pop rock album. And in most bands would be lucky to have achieved what they did with, you know, their first four albums. Bands would be like catastrophically delirious to like knock it out of the park once with Joshua Tree. They did it twice with Octung Baby. They did it with a different landscape, a different soundscape.
Two albums that couldn't sound more different.
In my mind, it is, and because it was a precursor to like the way they reinvented themselves on stage with the whole Zoo TV like motif, yeah. like it is the biggest and most successful reinvention of a band in terms of their sound, in terms of their look, in terms of the themes they're trying to get across since the Mop Tops went to Sgt. Pepper. Yeah. That is how drastic a change it is, and I will stand behind that.
The temptation of marital fidelity and the love of God and everything, when tempted by the excesses of fame and the party life, the moral corruption, the alienation, and it's just where I was as a very cynical and angry attitude at the time. It just, this worked for me. So yeah, The Fly that you mentioned there, the first single, I love that song. It's one of my favorites on the album. And it's just like,
but it's an insane song. It's an absolutely insane song.
It is. It's just like it's just this list of like almost like a grievance list and like kind of like going through these things. And then again, like this, the guitar that comes out of nowhere is one of my favorite solos. And then like the song that precludes that one, the So Cruel, as just this heartbreaking ballad that I also love, which again, I said this, it might be my favorite song on the album, but So Cruel.
And the song that follows it, A Mysterious Wage, which is like the sexiest thing they've ever done.
Yeah. Yeah. So much so that he brings it when he performed it live, he's got a dancer on the stage with him.
Yeah. I mean, like, listen, I don't think there's a skippable track on that record. I think like it takes you on like this journey of like industrial music to like, you know, quasi dance to like straight up guitar. But like you can still hear the Edge. It is still like the Edge's signature sound on Even Better Than the Real Thing on, you know, Until the End of the World, you know, yeah. like you hear Bono's plaintive wailing on one. It's like still embracing the same themes, but like more explicitly God and light and love and sex. But it is still a group of guys searching and yearning, you know, and like, I mean, and again, still painting in broad, bold, thematic landscapes. My God, trying to throw your arms around the world. Is there anything like more obvious and like themes than that? You know, and like, think of like the guitar work in Ultraviolet Light My Way, which is like a beautiful, redemptive song just when you feel like utterly lost, like while on this journey. Like, again, Octung Baby, man. Say what you will about that
band. Maybe Ultraviolet is my favorite song in the album.
It's an amazing song. But say what you will about that band. Like, you can hate them, but like, you got to respect that record. And like, this is true, again, of friends and contemporaries who like cannot stand them. But I'll be like, but Octung Baby? And they'll be like, they'll concede. Yeah, okay. Yeah, okay. It's great. What do you want from me? That's great. And like, the fact that they were 5 years older, 10 years older than like bands like Pearl Jam and Nirvana and like the Smashing Pumpkins. And they were like they set the tone with Octung Baby. That was like the pace setting album for the alternative sound in the early 90s. From that point on, all those other bands were chasing that sound, you know, and you can argue whether like they eclipsed it or they matched it or whatever. But like, that's the one, like that's the tone setting album of that era. And it established them as like having gone from like new wave post-punk to like earnest Christian to like mainstream rock to the alternative sound of the 1990s. Yeah. And that alone is also just like a minor miracle that they were able to like, you know, be these chameleons and pull it off all so well.
I debate in my head if I could make one adjustment to the album track list, if I would swap out Trying to Throw Your Arms Around the World for God Part 2 from Rattle and Hum, because I think God Part 2 sounds more like an Octoon Baby song than a Joshua Tree song. It might just be a little bit too much, though. It might just be, you might need that reprieve of Trying to Throw Your Arms Around the World in Octoon Baby. Yeah, I think the sound of God Part 2, even the drums, it sounds more...
Yeah, well, there's plain of wailing to it, you know, but like, I guess the thing that always bumps it down for me a little bit was that it was meant as a sequel to like a John Lennon song. Mm-hmm. And like, you know, it's again, it just seems like it's consciously trying to like ape something.
Yeah.
Whereas Trying to Throw Your Arms Around the World narratively, when you're left with like, you know, like sort of like the pits of despair of the middle of Octoon Baby and like, you know, the bizarreness of the fly and like the sexy confidence of Mysterious Ways, Trying to Throw Your Arms Around the World is like, again, like opening up vulnerable, you know, like showing a band that's still searching, which I really appreciate. I think it like fits perfectly. It's one of my favorite songs on that record.
Sunrise like a nosebleed, your head hurts and you can't breathe. You've been trying to throw your arms around the world. How far are you gonna go before you lose your way back home? You've been trying to throw your arms around the world.
So we started with Bad, and then we went to, that evolved into With or Without You.
Yeah.
And I think we get the next evolution of the song with One.
Did I disappoint you? Or leave a bad taste in your mouth? You act like you never had love. And you want me to go without. Well, it's too late.
And It is a different structure, but I think it is of that piece. And I think One is the song that I was thinking of when I said it was a soul song at heart.
Oh, sure.
And on the record, it doesn't sound like it. But I think what reveals it is in the earlier 2000s, U2 re-released the song with Mary J. Blige,
sure,
singing on the vocals. And I remember being curious, kind of cocking my head to the side. I was like, this is okay. Where are they going with this one? And listening to the song on its own and thinking, this is good, but there's something wrong with it. And I couldn't put my finger on what it was the first time I heard that version. And it took me a long time. It took me like a year of listening to that song on occasion, because I was like, I want to like the song a lot more than I do. Something is preventing me from. And part of it was the feeling like this is unnecessary. I was like, the song is already damn near perfect. Why, like, you're just adding something to that? And I was like, I don't know that her vocal track is additive. What I came away with later on was that, no, she is recontextualizing this song that I can feel in my bones in a very interesting way. It was the presence of you two on the collaboration that did not feel additive. And that's why I sent you a link to a video of Mary J. Blige performing the song without you two. It was a tribute for Nelson Mandela. You can find this on YouTube, guys. Check this one out. It's just Mary, might as well have been Aretha Franklin, or just like going to town on this song and taking this song away from like the sort of rock roots and making it this deep, soulful, gospel, belt 'em out masterpiece. to say her version alone is better than the album version, because I've lived and breathed with the album version for most of my life now. But God, if her version isn't, we used the word before, but transcendent. It is such a beautiful version. And it is a song that I think can be reinterpreted that way, because just recently, when the band was honored at the Kennedy Center, Eddie Vedder from Pearl Jam sang this song and did another masterful job, a masterful live performance. If you've seen him sing this song, one is just this incredible, incredible song. And again, it owes to being a little bit inscrutable in its meaning and its lyrics, but still able to capture this earworm flavor that you can sing along with it. And just like the tappiness of the drum key and the guitars, it's I think I want to say objectively it is their best song, but I might give that honor to With or Without You. I'm not sure. It's not my favorite, but I just want to say, like, the where the song exists in the musical ethos should be the top.
I love the song. I've come to love the song. I mean, it really came to life live. I the studio version left me a little bit cold, but the more I've listened to it live, the more I loved it. And I would echo your endorsement of the Mary J. Blige version on her own as a sort of transcendent experience. I think that what makes that song and that album resonate so much is there's a moment in the Rattle and Hum movie where he's like, he's about to go on stage with B.B. King to perform the song they collaborated on. And they're just kind of chatting. And B.B. King is just like, no, they're collaborating while they're recording the song. And B.B. King is just like, these lyrics are incredibly heavy. He's like, you're really, really young to write such heavy lyrics. And Bono was like 27 at the time. And he was like, he was 30, you know, which to me and you is pretty young to be, you know, to coming up with like lyrics like one, you know, you ask me to enter, you make me crawl. Like, I don't know. I don't know what it, some people are just struck by it, you know, like there's a saying that like genius comes in only three formats, that, you know, like genius comes in like something like chess or mathematics or music. The way they are lyrically, and the sort of effortless talent that he was able to utilize in coming up with a song like that, crafting a song like that, is it just takes your breath away. And I would just really quickly say that no discussion of that album and that era is complete without talking about like the concert backdrop on which they showcased it. Mm-hmm. Because one of the reasons they recorded Octung Baby, they wrote Octung Baby, and they made the turn that they did, was that, you know, one of the many criticisms they got at the end of the Rattle and Hum era was that, like, you are four very pious young gentlemen, you know, long-haired Christians with stern looks on their faces, who just like strum their guitars and like try to be open and earnest and like, you know, just very Christian. I mean, they had they were just a very Christian band, very earnest, very open-hearted, very hard on their sleeve, and it was just very uncool. And part of the deconstruction of U2 was in sort of smugly creating these alter egos that would keep an ironic detachment with a wink, you know, from the audience. And that went into the recording of Octung Baby. And, you know, Bono famously has said that Octung Baby represents the sound of four men chopping down the Joshua tree. But it also went into the concert presence, the Zoo TV tour, which, you know, was the featured showcase of the Octung Baby album, later the Zooropa album. You know, it went for this big bombastic arena football stadium presence, but like with a slick look, with like TV cameras everywhere, Bono dressed up in like a plethora of like potential alter egos, like the Fly character from the Fly song with the big googly like sunglasses, the leather jacket and the way too tight leather pants, the devilish character, Mr. Mephisto, and like this weird robo televangelist who would like grab the cameras on stage and like scream at people to like give them their money, like throw them their cash. And it was just meant to like create this ironic distance from the audience to like sort of lampoon and make fun of their old, you know, their old way too overstuffed serious image. And I think with the songs from Octung Baby, it just created this landscape of like deadly earnestness wrapped up in a winking, knowing smile. And it just, it was perfect because you could see Bono strutting around in the leather shades during Zoo TV and like thrusting his pelvis at the camera during Until the End of the World. But then the makeup would come off during One and he would just like sing this like plaintive love ballad, just kind of like, you know, opening his veins for us. And it was just a very neat backdrop and a perfect selling point for the album, and just kind of subverting the old U2 image. And I think Achtung Baby was just sort of the perfect soundscape for that next sonic adventure of theirs.
Which brings us to Zooropa. Continuing off of some of those themes, I was in a deep depression that I decided to write my way out of for the creative writing class, using Zooropa as my springboard. And poor Joe LoCascio, our teacher, who had to like read 4 drafts of this bullshit manuscript I'm coming up with as a short story. And I don't know if you read it or had to deal with this, but yeah, I tried to craft this narrative of myself having a dialogue with this album, basically just manifested in the human form of our friend as a means of like having like this therapeutic, trying to find like get out of my own head and trying to find some catharsis from the line, "You've got the right shoes to get you through the night." And fuck, 17-year-old Ryan. I mean, I did a lot of drugs back in those days, Omar, and there was some weirdness in this. But
hey, listen, it's a perfect backdrop to exercise your weirdness and flex your weird muscles. It is, in the U2 catalog, it is a weird album. In my mind, it is their probably crowning artistic achievement. I would really go to bat for this album. I think coming off the heels of like the stunning and redemptive arc of Achtung Baby and like the new sonic landscape they had invented and like sort of the send up of their image they had successfully managed with Zoo TV, reinventing themselves for like the ironic 90s, all with a wink and a smile. I think Zooropa is this like unbelievably bizarre, beautiful, messy, you know, like it was originally supposed to be this like quick EP project to like sort of fill the days in between legs of the Zoo TV world tour. And some of the songs just ended up slapping so much that they were like, well, let's dash off an album with this. Let's see what we got. And to me, it just ends up being a perfect distillation of their 90s artistic sonic ambition. I think it takes their industrial electronica fixation to like a perfect conclusion. And I think pop sometimes steps over it, which is why pop kind of represents an endpoint of that era, the way Rattle and Hum represented an endpoint of their late 80s America fixation. But like Zooropa is sort of like the perfect distillation. I mean, you have like Flood and Brian Eno along with The Edge co-producing, and you just have this like weirdness, like these weird sonic landscapes, but like held under the discipline of Bono's songwriting. So you have the Zooropa title track, which is this hazy, beautiful mess, again, with also, you know, a redemptive arc and with like lyrics that just like can bring tears to the eyes. You know, "You've got the right shoes to get you through the night." You've got like the Numb song, which was their first weird single off of this, which is just basically The Edge, you know, just
mumbling.
just mumbling with Bono doing his fat lady falsetto. You have Lemon with Bono like singing about his mother, like, you know, through this weird pastiche of just like sounds from an arcade video game that sound like. But you also have like a traditional songs like Stay Far Away, So Close, like a simple guitar ballad, which a lot of people, you know, which is one of people's favorite songs. You have, which to my mind, the best song on the album, one of the best songs they've ever done, The First Time.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, his soul song from that album.
"I feel myself going down. I just call and it comes around. But for the first time, I feel love."
there are many mansions, there are many rooms to see. I left by the back door and I threw away the key.
Yeah.
And trying to find God. You have The Wanderer with Johnny Cash.
Yes.
It is their most versatile album. It is their most experimental album. I think it is artistically their best album, even if it's not the statement signature record that Joshua Tree and Octung Baby provide. I think it is U2 flexing their creative muscles at the top of their game. You know, I'll never forget like a review from Newsweek that said that like with this album, U2 has proved that they are worthy of whatever absurd mutations the 1990s throw our way. And I think that's right. I love that album. I love that album. I know it's not a lot of people's favorites. I know it's really out there in terms of like, you know, the sounds that are emanating from the band. Like the guitar structure is traditional guitar structure, like three chords and the truth are pretty much missing. But I think you get a really enriching, you know, journey in exchange for that. And it just really kind of proves what they're capable of as craftsmen, as artists, as weirdos.
I think what might have turned people off of it, as you said, like every song is almost a different subgenre, and it's almost like they were like just going through it. It's like, all right, where, what can we, like, we've got this fragment of a song, where can we spin this that we haven't gone before?
Yeah.
Whereas other albums might feel more cohesive.
Yeah, that's
sonically,
right.
Sonically,
yeah, I think the only
it was almost like, yeah, it was, yep, like, almost like they were kind of like, no, let's not try and have a sonic cohesion to,
yeah,
this song.
And the only sonic cohesion is like weird.
Yeah.
Just weirdness. And that can hang together in a lot of contexts, and it certainly hangs together for me, but I can certainly appreciate how it would be all over the place for people. And like, you know, very tellingly, I mean, listen, it was a multi-platinum album. It won the Grammy for Best Alternative Album, which is very funny. And I remember Bono, you feel free to bleep this out, but like, they were just very surprised. And like, Bono collected the Grammy and he just like went up to the microphone and he was just like, I have a message I would like to give to the youth of America. And that is this: you two will continue to abuse our position and fuck up the mainstream. Thank you very much. But like, yeah, no, I totally understand the fact that it was just a left turn, but like, it still did incredible business, multi-platinum, Grammy winning, critical acclaim. But like, clearly it was like existing on the fumes of Octung Baby 2 with a lot of people. There was momentum that they were riding and they were like, well, let's see this as far as it'll go. But I just do think there are many, many, many nuggets of genius on that record. The title track, I think Numb is beautiful. The Numb music video too.
Yeah.
And all these supermodels are just like poking at the edge as he's trying to maintain a poker face. Lemon is beautiful. Stay Far Away, So Close. The First Time, The Wanderer. These are just like genius level songs.
Daddy's going to play for your pet.
Oh, I love that song. I love that song.
Didn't you call in WDEK and request that song for one of your classmates who may have had a car accident or something?
I did. And like, the DJ at the time was just like, I don't know if we can do that, but I can play one. Do you like one? We can do one. Desperately trying to get out of the conversation with me, as well he should have. It was, yeah, a commercial suicide.
The year of Pearl Jam's Versus and the Smashing Pumpkins' Siamese Dream. But yeah, Zooropa stole the award for Best Alternative Album, and that's what Bono meant, like, continuing to fuck up the mainstream.
Yeah, and nice. Like, listen, deservedly so. I mean, like, at that point in the game, they were still, like, the pace setters for all those bands. Those bands were, like, coming into their own, and they were gaining a lot of commercial, you know, acclaim and notoriety, and, like, I think Versus is, you know, Pearl Jam's sort of commercial peak, Nirvana within Utero, but, like, they were looking to U2, and they were speaking quite, you know, admiringly of U2 in both their sort of creative ambition, but also their ambition to be big and to be the best, which is something that a lot of those guys could not personally relate to, but like, they could at least like understand and respect it.
As the 90s kind of came to a close, they released another album with Pop in 1996, which, as you said, this was them kind of taking the techno dance electronica sound to its conclusion for them anyway. precursing what would come with, you know, other artists in this genre, like Fatboy Slim, like the next year would have huge hits in this type of
Prodigy
thing.
Yeah,
this was the sort of sound. The band was also kind of splitting up and doing a lot of more like little smaller, little solo or duo acts that we mentioned, the sort of like fractures of where they were. On one hand, you have Bono and the Edge writing songs for Tina Turner for one of the James Bond movies, for GoldenEye. Right? They also wrote a song for and with Roy Orbison with She's a Mystery Girl, which I love that song. Great Roy Orbison track. And it seemed like, okay, Bono and the Edge go off and write this big hit James Bond song. All right, so what is the forgotten rhythm duo going to do with Adam and Larry? Oh, they're just going to re-record the theme to Mission Impossible for this little Mission Impossible comeback movie starring Tom Cruise that becomes like a huge smash hit. Like this one instrumental theme piece is like on MTV every 5 minutes and is like this huge hit, and I'm sure was a bigger single than GoldenEye was. So.
Oh, it absolutely was. Yeah. And it just gave them an opportunity to sort of like test their limits as a rhythm section. They had also done, you know, a side project, like a collection of songs to be the soundtrack for a bunch of ambient films that did not actually exist, called Passengers Original Soundtracks 1, which just kind of allowed them to get super, super weird. So, you know, having all this time to just sort of like tickle their collective funny bone and be self-indulgent, you know, they came back and they saw the trend, as you suggested, with like, you know, Tricky and Prodigy, you know, and I think they felt like we can really be at the forefront of this sort of like electronica dance movement, just as they saw what was happening with industrial music and alternative music at the beginning of the 90s. And this is what persuaded them in 1996 to start recording with like Flood as producer and like Nellie Hooper and Howie B, you know, a very sprawling album that had dance electronica as, you know, its foundation. That ended up ironically being called pop, when in fact the substance of the album was kind of anything but. And you had indicated this is one of their, you know, one of their first albums that you would listen to contemporaneously, correct?
Yeah, I got this when it came out because I was hoping for more of that Batman song that Hold Me, Throw Me, Kiss Me, Kill Me. And I didn't get it. And there were songs on it that I liked and songs that kind of spoke to me and other songs that I just kind of like forgot about. And I mentioned to you also before that this was an album that I don't think I've listened to in full since 2001 or 2002 until we were prepping for this show. I just kind of like forgot about this one. And I went back and into it. And some of the songs that I had forgotten about, like Mofo and Last Night on Earth, I really dug when I heard them again with fresh ears. I wish I'd had more appreciation for this at the time. The one song on this album that I always loved from the first time I heard it, and actually my appreciation grew, was the song Please. And again, this was another one where I found the album version to be good, but the single version, the version that was released as a single, was slightly different, a little bit of a different mix than the album version. And the difference is with that single mix, it lets the Edge play through his guitar solo at the end. And you hear more of his guitar work in like the last fading minute of the song. And it just, that instrument, that inclusion of it is just something really, really special.
An album that this was one of my most anticipated releases ever, because this was the first album, new album they released after my fandom had started. So like my anticipation level was like off the charts. And what I will say about it, I mean, like, you know, I tried to force myself to really fall in love with it. And I really admired the ambition again, because, you know, I really looked at it as part of a piece with Octung Baby and Zooropa as like sort of representing the, you know, culmination of like their 90s journey. But what I will say as I look back on it over 25 years later is that, you know, with Octung, I mean, it really is of a piece with Rattle and Hum more than anything else, as like the end of a journey, because the commonality it has with Rattle and Hum is that, like, as with the Joshua Tree and Octung Baby and Zooropa, like, you can see them be inspired as songwriters and producers and musicians. You can see them be inspired, whether it's by America with the Joshua Tree and their encounters with, like, American roots music and, like, you know, American classic American artists, or being inspired by the industrial sounds and, like, of like new Europe, in the early 1990s. And with Zooropa just being sort of free to experiment and just, let's see what happens. Let's do this. Pop is the first time in a long time since really Rattle and Hum where you just sort of start to see the wheels turning in their heads. It's almost, to me, feels like a labored conscious attempt to capture sort of an alchemy and a feeling. And you can sort of see them laboring to do it. I don't dispute the fact that there are some really great songs on that album. I actually think the lead single Discotheque is pretty cool. I think you're right that Please does come alive. I think a lot of the other songs are half formed or 75% formed great ideas. The band always insisted that, like, because they had booked and prepared a very ambitious tour to support this, very much in the vein of Zoo TV, the Pop Mart tour, which was going to be this big, bold football stadium only worldwide tour with, like, the giant LED screen that had, like, this biggest screen in the history of, you know, screens, with them dressed up in, like, ironic, kitschy costumes, like, lambasting, I guess, pop consumerism or whatever. Because they were so focused on getting the tour underway, they claim that, like, you know, the songs weren't really finished when they released them. I don't know how much I buy that. I just think that you can sort of see the ideas being, like, labored over. You can just see the wheel spinning in their minds. It just seems like a try hard record, you know, an almost like, hey, let's capture a feeling, let's capture a mood in a way that was, like, sort of effortless with Octung Baby, because the ideas just came to them, or with Zooropa, where it's just like, oh, let's just get weird. Who knows? Let's just see what happens. But with here, it's like, we are going to capture a feeling, damn it. It's going to happen. We're going to, like, wrangle this. And it's going to work. And so, like, you have these industrial electronic sounds that just feel like, it's almost like in this situation, like with all this talk of AI in the year 2023, it almost feels like trying to get an AI program to, like, capture what, like, an industrial sized sound album would sound like in, like, the late 90s. Like, let's get ahead of the curve. Let's set the tone. Let's do this. So I've just never been able to revisit that album with, like, love, even though, again, I admire the ambition. With you too, it's like same as it ever was, right? Like, you swing for the fences and you either connect or you don't. But I you know, after months and months and over a year of trying to make that album kind of happen when it came out, I just kind of gave up the struggle. Saw the Pop Mart tour. It was the first time I'd ever seen them in concert. It was incredible. It was garish. It was anthemic. It was huge. It was Bono hiding his heart on his sleeve behind a wink and a nod, but, like, ended up bearing his soul for all of us. It was beautiful, but, like, it really overshadowed what I thought was a very muddled, confused record. Lots of things to admire, but, like, a hard album to really get into.
All right, well, then we go to the 21st century. All That You Can't Leave Behind in 2000, which, as another transitional point, this was a transition for me, leaving high school, going to college, becoming a different person emotionally and kind of just personally. And this is where me and the band kind of started to deviate. I didn't feel as devoted and dependent on the message that I was getting from the music here. Basically, for the band of the last 20 years, I have been more of a casual fan of the singles. I listened to All That You Can't Leave Behind. I really liked the album when it came out. I liked How to Dismantle an Atomic Bomb. But in large part, I haven't stuck with those songs. There have been a handful of songs from the more modern era that I really do like, and a couple that I can talk about. But in terms of what I would say the modern output, I mean, where do you categorize this era of the band, kind of starting in 2000 and going up till now?
Like, look, I would separate All That You Can't Leave Behind a little bit from the ones of the last, like, 10 or 15 years. I do think that was a mission album that was a very important album for them. I think that like they realized that like from a commercial and critical standpoint, they had really lost their way with pop. I mean, the sentiments I was just talking about with regard to my reception of pop, that's not like this unique situation that was unique to me. That was basically the collective, you know, response of the fans and the music media, largely hostility / indifference. You know, who were these people? They seemed out of step. You know, I mean, at a time when like, you know, they tried to capture the zeitgeist because they figured Prodigy and like, you know, Tricky would be the ones that would be, you know, at the center of culture, but it ended up being like the Spice Girls and Hanson. And so they just seemed hopelessly out of step. And so, you know, they were sort of at a crossroads. And I feel like Bono always says this, that album, All That You Can't Leave Behind, was them sort of humbly reapplying for the job of like best band in the world. And there was this sort of signpost moment where like they were just kind of hashing around ideas and the Edge let loose with like a classic, you know, U2 riff that ended up being like, you know, the bridge on All That You Can't, or the, on Beautiful Day, the first single. And Bono just, you know, said, we can't do that. That sounds too much like U2. And Edge was like, hey, sod off, as the Europeans say. Like, we are U2. Like, we're not going to like run away from this and we're not going to do something just to be different. And I think that planted a seed with them. I think the success of the Sweetest Thing single in 1998 also planted a seed with them. And I think they really dug deep and challenged themselves to do a retro album, a retro pop album that suited their sensibilities at the turn of the century. And I think, you know, in crafting Beautiful Day, which really was their swing for the fences to regain cultural, commercial, and critical relevance, they succeeded. Beautiful Day is as close to like a perfectly constructed pop song as you're going to get in the last like quarter century. So I think All That You Can't Leave Behind was really a mission statement. I would really put it in their top five or top six albums as like a conscious return to classic U2 that somehow feels effortless. I think, you know, Beautiful Day, the single Stuck in a Moment You Can't Get Out Of, Elevation, which to this day, you know, 23 years later is like a concert staple, Walk On, which is like, you know, a fan favorite. I think that album, you know, really reestablished themselves as like the vanguard of culture. I think it is a simple album. I think it is a stripped down album. But I think it confronts aging, mortality, being 40, which is, you know, around the age that we are now, and wrestling with those issues without ever seeming out of step. So I would really separate out the contemporary U2 from All That You Can't Leave Behind, which I think has sort of taken its place alongside, you know, maybe not the Joshua Tree and Octung Baby, but in that next rung of like, you know, the War, the Unforgettable Fire of like classic U2 records. So I think it's the subsequent ones where you can really start to take a look and be like, okay, well, this is just represents a chapter of the band that is, you know, I'm just kind of out of step with. Again, I also think how to dismantle an atomic bomb is also, you know, an effort of theirs to be loud and bombastic and sort of grungy a little bit. And it had, you know, oodles and oodles of success, sold millions of records, you know, like it you know, it kicked them off on another incredible worldwide tour. They won a boatload of Grammys, including the Album of the Year Grammy. By the way, I would also go back and say All That You Can't Leave Behind took on special resonance because it was the September 11th album. Yeah. You know, a few months after it was released, 9/11 happened, and it just sort of took on a new resonance. They were invited to play the Super Bowl and like they earned like a whole like new worldwide legion of fans. And it really was this like, you know, like shot of adrenaline into the cultural relevancy and potency of the band that they were starting to lose in the late 90s. But yes, as time has gone on, you know, because I'm a super fan, I will sort of follow where they go, no pun intended. But, you know, I do think your mileage does tend to vary with the contemporary stuff.
Well, and I also think, I mean, in part, the product they have put out in the last 15 years, I mean, as a band, they have become grown-up rock stars.
Yeah.
And it's there's no way of avoiding it. Now, we know from what we've seen that there can always be a little bit of embarrassment that goes along with an aged rock star trying to perform like they're still in their 20s or 30s. Look at the Rolling Stones. And yeah, they can still do it, but... boy, you know, Mick Jagger. Like, but I think they've avoided that. Like, this is a band that has grown up. As you said, this is going to be the first time that they haven't had the four original core members. They have been remarkably without scandal or controversy or any kind of really outside exterior destructive force that would change up the band or doom them in any other way.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think that just like, you know, to the earlier point I was making about how like they straddle genres, they've straddled everything, and now they're just in the classic dad rock genre. And I think any other thing would be inauthentic. I think any other thing would like ring false. And I think that like, listen, it's what I was saying earlier about genius being in the, you know, like within the confines of like chess or mathematics or music. One of the things about genius is that like there aren't a lot of people who do genius work after they're like 25 or 30 years old in those realms, right? So like the construct of Bono singing urgently about like love and like death and like war and peace and like drug addiction and like, you know, and friendship and yearning for spirituality, that's going to hit different when you're 20 and 25 and 30 years old and coming into your own, as opposed to like when you're like a millionaire who jets off to Davos meetings and like, you know, and who like literally lives and owns a castle and is like hobnobbing with like, you know, like Barack Obama and Bill Gates and like the Queen of England and like, you know, it's just different. You're not going to have that that torn ripped from the headlines urgency to like prove yourself that you did before. As long as you don't embarrass yourself, I'm fine with it. And I think like, you know, post All That You Can't Leave Behind, like I would still go to bat for a lot of the songs they've done. You know, I think the Vertigo single on as nonsensical as some of the lyrics are is howling and like good fun. I think, you know, the Miracle of Joey Ramone from the Songs of Innocence album is tremendous. Every Bait Breaking Wave, which has made an impression on audiences. There are a couple of singles off the one they did 5 years ago, Songs of Experience. You're the Best Thing About Me, and the other is Get Out of Your Own Way. Look, I would put that like alongside some of the best stuff they did, you know, like for the last 25 years.
When they released the U2 18 singles album, one of the new ones with that one, Window in the Skies, I think is a beautiful song. I love that song a lot.
Yeah, like it's just tremendous. Like, look, I think bands get older, bands age. I don't think they embarrass themselves. I think the records are all good. And I think it's very predictable that so much of the fuss about U2 is about stuff that has nothing to do with the music. Like when Songs of Innocence came out, they took a lot of crap for the release method, as you alluded to at the beginning of the episode, the fact that it was automatically downloaded into people's phones. And it's like, hey, fine. I get that you're upset about that. It's been 9 years and people are still upset about that. And it's like stunning to me. And like, I try to put myself in the shoes of fans. And I look at like artists that like are huge acts that I don't really care for or know that much about. And so I'm picking on Mariah Carey. Mariah Carey fans, I'm very sorry. I don't mean this. I think she's perfectly fine. I'm just not into her. I'm not into the music. If a Mariah Carey album was like downloaded onto my phone without my knowledge, I would not care that much. I would be like, I didn't ask for this, whatever. But like the fit that people threw, I think was disproportional to, you know, the offense that actually occurred. And I think it overshadowed what I think was a pretty damn good album. You know, and I think the last two albums, the Songs of Innocence and Songs of Experience, are of a piece. Songs of Innocence, especially harkening back to the early days growing up in Dublin, and you know, the experience of like overcoming adolescence and like making it. I think looking back on that from the vantage point of like 50-something, 60-year-old men is interesting, worth exploring. And like they have a lot of singles that I really love.
That was a pre-Trump world there that we complained about different things back in 2014.
Yeah, it sure is. And then I would say Songs of Experience is a response, very much a response to a Donald Trump world. So I would really urge the listening audience, go and listen to those two albums. I mean, like, look, if you don't know the U2 catalog, obviously the classic stuff is the must listen to, you know, Joshua Tree, Octung Baby, and then like War, Unforgettable Fires, Europa, All That You Can't Leave Behind. But like, you know, for heaven's sake, if you've cycled through that stuff, give the new stuff, you know, a spin. Like it's not bad. I think a lot of it is very good. The singles, I think, are terrific. Love hurts. Now you're the girl who's
I want to be cautious in saying that, like, I think they've settled into a comfortable zone, as you would imagine people of their age and their station as rock stars would do. But they don't sound lazy. I would never accuse them of being that. And you mentioned that there is still an earnestness and a sincerity about what they're doing. And I think maybe the difference, the real telling difference that kind of keeps it away, is I feel like they can still craft a pop song, but to me, I can see it coming from muscle memory.
Yeah.
And I don't see the real spark. I don't see the moment of inspiration where this is something new.
Yeah.
It just seems like they're a machine. They're a pop music making machine at this point. And it's like, okay, that in itself is amazing, but it's not rock and roll. It's like,
that's totally fine. I think that is the best summarized, most eloquent sort of appraisal and critique of the contemporary U2 sound. Like it is morphed into like in very intelligent, well done dad rock. One of my best friends has, you know, an analogy that he likes to like zing me with. He's a really big film guy. And he calls U2 the James Cameron of musicians, where it's like, you know, you see a James Cameron movie and it's like, they're really good. And, you know, in the past there was a lot super inventive about it. And like, you know, really urgent and really memorable. But like at this point, like it is a extremely exceptionally well-made product on an assembly line that is intelligent and a few cuts above normal products on the assembly line. But it's still like, this is not essential. And while the super fan in me, the fanboy in me like rejects that, the objective person in me is like, oh, that's a totally fine analogy. Like this is, you know, Avatar 2, Avatar 3, which is, you know, it's fine. It's good. It has its merits. And I think there are moments in, you know, the recent Avatar movies that really pop for me that it's like, oh, I'm glad I went to the movie theater for this. But I'm not going to be like, you know, sitting, you know, my grandchildren on my knee talking about like, you know, the Avatar movies. You know, early James Cameron is something to behold. And that's something to talk about. But like, you know, now you're right. I think the analogy you made as well is excellent. I come back to some of those singles from the last couple albums. I think they're terrific, but you are right. Like you can see it's sort of the product of a machine. And as it should be, if a 60-year-old has something urgent to say about like love and yearning, like I am going to be mighty suspicious about the kind of psychotropic drugs that 60-year-old is ingesting. They have had their time. They have connected more often than not. Their, you know, the merits of the band and their sound and the sonic landscape and the songwriting has far outweighed the detriments. They have brought an inventive twist to the live show. They have made the musical experience a transcendent one. If and when they tour again, I will shell out the money to go see them because it's a wonderful experience. And if their destiny, their lot in life, the stage in time is to end up like a more refined, less embarrassing version of the Rolling Stones, I'm here for it. That's fine. Like they have done their job. They have served their audience well. They have served God well, you know, to use Bono's metrics. And I am, you know, I think we are better off for having had them, even if the urgency and the fire and the passion is gone.
Was a time, a window in my life when I needed help figuring out my personal life, my relationships with people, with God, sexuality, carnality, all of this, and my friends helped me out. You chiefly among them, but so did this weird.
I did not help you out with carnality. I did not help you out with sexuality. I just want to make very clear. I did not help you out with those things.
Fair enough. Thank you. Good clarification there. But you pointed me towards a rock band of all things that did help me explore those in my mind, my personal headspace. There's just this. I mean, this is a band that we've chronicled a long history, but if nothing else, there is this window in between of like 5 to 6 years where just some of the greatest music in rock and roll history, yep, I think, was ever produced. And I don't think that is a minority opinion, because if you look
at
Billboard
either.
And Rolling Stones lists, I mean, Joshua Tree and Ocking Baby, yep, are all time.
They will always be there. Yep. And can I also say, like, to your point, you know, that point of like, say whatever else you will. And like, I'm very, very happy to hear that, you know, they've been a touchstone for you at personal moments when there were tough times or whatever. They've just always been a touchstone for me since I grew into adolescence. But, you know, the other thing I would say, and like, this is just sort of an ephemeral point that doesn't really matter all that much, but like, I do think it might score brownie points. Like, they're also good dudes. Like, I mean, you can't really know too much about rock and roll bands. And I hesitate in this day and age to like sort of go to bat for anyone and their personality and their personal life, just because, you know, the rug is pulled out from under us too much to, you know, have false idols. And, you know, who knows, maybe there's going to be some Me Too story will come out about, like, you know, The Edge groping a waitress. But I don't know. Like, I don't know that that's going to happen. But like, you know, at heart, these are four people that for all the incoming they take, what are they really criticized for? They're criticized for being too self-serious, for too much do-gooding, for like not following the rock and roll cliche of like getting trashed in hotel rooms and like, you know, succumbing to drug addiction or like stupid fights over money or anything like that. They're just like four earnest, fun dudes who, like, when you see through the bombast, don't actually take themselves all that seriously. They are very funny. They are hyper intelligent. Like, for all of Bono's clownishness and buffoonishness, he is like actually a very cool hang. Like, mm-hmm, from, you know, he is someone who is like I would really urge people who have the time and the inclination to do like deep dives on like Bono and The Edge and Adam and Larry, with like deep dive interviews, long form interviews. They are very funny. They are very self-effacing. They are very good critics of culture. They are very, and like, my God, if the worst thing you can say about them is that like they're, and by the way, I would say that like Zoo TV and the Ocktongue Baby 90s era proved that they were good at like having tongue planted firmly in cheek. And
oh,
like,
yeah, the self-awareness, yeah.
Yeah, self-awareness, subverting themselves. Like, they are often in on the joke. Like, they know that people think they're buffoons and like they are happy to run with it. And like, my God, if the worst thing you can say about Bono and these guys is that like, oh my God, I don't want my rock stars lecturing to me about like AIDS in Africa, or like, you know, the plight of poverty, or like civil rights, you know, like, my God, to see Bono like getting a Lifetime Achievement Award from the NAACP and to have him stand up there sheepishly pointing out that he himself is not in fact African-American. it's very funny. Like, these are good guys. Like, these are guys, you know, I just think that that should go to something.
I can't believe I completely forgot about this until this moment. I saw Bono live. I was in the room. He came to the University of Iowa when I was a student there in the 2000s and was doing a thing for AIDS Relief for Africa. It was Bono and Ashley Judd, yeah, the two of them. And they were just like doing that. I saw this whole thing. And at the end of it, like after we were kind of like, it would have been cool to see you too. And he's like, well, the other band isn't here, but here, I've got this demo we played of like a song. And he just put like the CD of like the other three on as a backup track. And he had an acoustic guitar and played one of the songs. I think it would have been a song from How to Dismantle the Atomic Bomb.
Sure, probably.
But
yeah.
It wasn't Vertigo. I can't think of what, yeah, song it might have been now, but yeah, but that was.
Yeah, he knows that. Like, he always talks about like how he is a megalomaniac, and like he has lyrics that are like, you know, the right to be ridiculous is something I hold very dear. Like, he knows he is a buffoon, you know, like you don't have to point it out. Like, they get it. But like, they're actually very cool guys, especially for guys that like pasty white guys in their 60s. Like, they've done it. They've made the journey. They've made incredible music. They are not assholes. Like it is, they subverted the cliches of rock and roll. And to the extent they haven't, they have like wrapped their arms around the contradictions and given them like a big wet kiss. Like, it is okay to actually like U2. It is okay to love U2, which is why I do. I wear my U2 love on my sleeve these days. Like, and that's the dirty little secret about them. Whatever else you can say about them, the dirty little secret is they are cool. The music is cool. The guys are cool. The band is cool. And, like, I will die on that note.
Before we go, favorite deep cut, like not one of the singles. It doesn't have to be super deep, but not one of the singles, or not one of the. Yeah.
So I would say, we talked about it previously. I would say, on Octung Baby, Ultraviolet Light My Way. I would also say an honorable mention is One Tree Hill off of
Joshua Tree.
I would say the 40 off of War, which is the song Psalm 40, you know, going back to the, again, earnest Christianness, like this is a Christian band that they close a lot of their concerts with, the Psalm 40. And you know, I think they have so many deep cuts. That's the thing. They are not just a singles band, although their singles like Swing for the Fences and More Often Than Not Connect, like their deep cuts are excellent. And their albums are narrative threads. I really don't think that they are a singles band, although their singles I would put up against any other band singles.
There is a silence that comes to a house where no one can sleep. I guess it's the price of love. I know it's not cheap. Oh, come on, baby, 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 light my.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I had Ultraviolet on the tip of my tongue too, but I'm also going to say So Cruel from Octung Baby.
Yeah.
In terms of the big ones, yeah, it's almost tied between One and With or Without You as what I think is their ultimate one, maybe.
Yeah,
With
that's
or Without
their,
You. That's just.
Of course. And I would just say, like, again, like to the audience, like the other thing about U2 that sets them apart is like the live sound. And so, you know, I just think that, like Springsteen, like The Who, to have gone a life and not seen them live once, if you were vaguely interested in their music, would be doing yourself a very real disservice. So like, get out and see them live. It's an incredible experience. If you're not able to see them live for logistics or because like they're insanely expensive, which they are, I would point people to the Rattle and Hum concert film. I would point them to Zoo TV Live from Sydney, Pop Mart Live from Mexico City. They did a Slane Castle. They have a Slane Castle film from the Elevation Tour in 2001, a Chicago album from 2005, the Vertigo
Tour. That's a good show, too. The Chicago one is good.
Yeah, like, guys, and if you're not willing to, like, you know, like, get it on Amazon or whatever, just go on YouTube. They have all the clips. Yeah. Like, U2 Live is an incredible sound, an incredible experience, very much in the Springsteen and Who mode. Like, live is where they live, Larry Mullen always says, and, like, I absolutely believe that. They are, at heart, a really great live band.
Awesome. Very, very cool. All right, then. Omar, thank you very much. As I mentioned, you've been on several past episodes of Fire and Water Records. You've been on the Film and Water podcast, Cheerscast, Pod Dylan sometimes. So, yeah.
Star Wars. Don't forget Star Wars. My God, come on.
And there might be a Star Wars episode in the future. We'll see how the season of Mandalorian goes.
Absolutely. No. Yeah, I'm happy to be here. I'm happy to be a part of a frenemy of the Fire and Water Network. Y'all can reach me on Twitter at @OUDDIN, Instagram, OUDDIN17, and I'm here for all of your legal and other esoteric needs.
Fire and Water Records is a proud part of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. Feedback for the show can be left at fireandwaterpodcast.com as well as the Facebook page for Fire and Water Records. Special thanks to our Patreon supporters. For more information on how you can support the Fire and Water Podcast Network, visit patreon.com/FWPodcasts. All music clips and quoted lyrics are used for entertainment purposes. Please support the artists and their work by purchasing or downloading the songs legally. Thanks for listening, and happy St. Patrick's Day!